On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we continue our discussion of the 2020 proposed regulations of HOPD and ASC reimbursement. We'll discuss the new procedures added, review changes to the Medicare quality reporting system, announce New York State's cost reporting deadline in October. We'll talk about infection risks with upper endoscopy lubricants and discuss USP 800's impact on ASCs that perform ophthalmology cases. CPT codes and descriptions are the copyright of the American Medical Association. All rights are reserved.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource their regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys.
Welcome to episode 63 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for August 18th, 2019, recording from our studio in Spencerport, New York. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and I'm here with John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and one of the leading experts in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry and the author and co-author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, including the Survey Guide for ASCs. John speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics. So we just got back from our vacation in Aruba.
I know.
So we're readjusting.
Not very well. And by the way, did you notice that the swimming pool outside is green, which is not the same color?
Not quite as pretty as the green, blue, aqua water in Aruba, but
I know, we can pretend. I guess I need to spend a little more time and hire somebody to fix it. I don't know what to do.
So our last recording, we recorded from Aruba, so we were, you know, didn't have the same equipment, so we apologize if it was kind of
we do. Plus, we had a
not
weird
the best quality
background noise, so we're back in our studio here. But this has been a sad day for me. My youngest daughter, Kristen, moved out from the house, and she's got her own apartment, so I helped her move in. So that's why we're recording this quite late in the evening here. But the good news is, I'm very happy for her, obviously. Now she's got her own new apartment, and she's really growing up. And, of course, she's 26 years old.
I know,
she has grown up. Yeah, she's kind of living in our in-law apartment downstairs. But the good news is that we're going to be turning her old bedroom into our new studio coming up. So
very exciting.
So the new studio is going to be larger. It's going to be quieter with better acoustics. And hopefully you'll notice the difference when we finally do move down there.
May take us a little while.
I know.
Everything's set up, but that's our plan.
So busy right now. This last week was busy, and I'm leaving tomorrow for our final environmental inspection for our new center opening in Connecticut. We're very excited. One of our dear listeners who learned about us through the ASC podcast with John Gailey, her center opens, well, hopefully within the next month and a half. So I'm very excited to get out there and kind of get the ball rolling finally on at least the state licensure there.
Yep, and our new center in northern Manhattan is still on a delay because of the fire department.
So absolutely, and we love New York City, but the delays in every area there just are really frustrating to our clients down there and just so difficult from a construction standpoint. And same thing's happening with our new center going up in Garden City, which has had more delays, unfortunately, this time because of some construction problems. Just goes on to show, though, Sue, that, when you set these wonderful deadlines, I don't know that I've ever seen any deadline come even close to being.
They're more of a suggestion.
That's right.
Really, totally. Because, just like in anything in life, things happen, things come up, you just have to be flexible.
So, and we're not going to be seeing Alex for a while because New York State just issued the software for the annual cost report. Mm-hmm. So if your center is in New York, you have until October 15th to file it. And if you're not from New York State, just be grateful that you don't have to file a cost report and pray that CMS never makes this a national requirement. Mm-hmm. And I guess we should point out, since we're going to talk a little bit about, kind of follow up on our conversation about the new regulations for 2020, the regulations did not come out, thankfully, with a requirement for cost reporting as had been recommended by MedPAC. So at least another year that we don't have to worry about that at the national level. But if you're in New York, you do have to file one. So I did want to kind of talk about some of a recent issue that's been coming up. One of my colleagues from Mobius Therapeutics I spoke to last week, and she said that we really need to be taking USP 800 seriously. And I'll admit, up until now, I don't think we've spent a lot of time talking too much about it. So I'm going to have her, I'm hopefully going to have her on an upcoming episode. But I did want to at least give everybody some warning and tell you to kind of go out and look at the information that's available on the internet about this. Yeah. So USP 800 is coming, and it's effective December 1st, 2019. You're going to have to review the list of NIOSH or NIOSH drugs, which the hazardous drugs. And basically, yet another risk assessment that you're going to have to do every year, which is to identify if any of these drugs are in your organization. And then the doses that you're going to handle, perform the risk assessment and document this review annually. The risk assessment is going to have to include the drug, the dosage, and the form, the risk of exposure, the packaging, the manipulation of that drug, documentation of alternative containment strategies in our work and your practices. At the present time, the major impact for our listeners is going to be on those centers that do eye surgery. So mitomycin is considered a hazardous drug, and most, I believe, of our centers that handle eye cases have mitomycin in there. So it's going to have to be handled differently after the implementation of USP 800 in December. So if you want more information, there are great resources available at ASORN, that is the American Society of Operating Room Nurses, and that's at asorn.org. If you do go to that website, follow the link for professional resources and download mitomycin C learning module and tip sheet. So I did want to just mention a couple things on the tip sheet, so we'll work on this together here. So one of the things you're going to have to do when you're administering mitomycin C is follow the steps for safe drug administration. Obviously, make sure you have the correct patient, the correct drug, the correct dose and strength, the correct route and site, and the correct application time. You have to avoid exposure to unintended tissue.
And you want to be sure you irrigate well from the eye following administration.
Right. So other changes are going to require us to kind of document the use of mitomycin much more strenuously than we have in the past. So we're going to document the following information in the OR record.
You have to document the strength of the mitomycin and the amount of time that the mitomycin was administered, the number of mitomycin saturated sponges that were placed in or removed from the patient's eye, and also the lot number from the package.
And then disposing of mitomycin is going to be different. We're going to have to dispose of it in a mitomycin container, soak sponges and surgical waste materials that have come in contact with the drug. That includes the gowns, the gloves, the patient drapes, have to be disposed of in an appropriate chemotherapy disposal container. So that is a big difference.
That's a lot of stuff. You know.
That is going to be a huge change. So, and handling instruments used with mitomycin C?
You want to restrict the instruments used to handle the mitomycin sponges from use in other parts of the surgical procedure. Rinse and clean the instruments used to handle the mitomycin prior to sterilizing them for use on a subsequent case. And consider using disposable instruments to handle the mitomycin sponges.
Absolutely. Good idea. So, and managing accidental release or spill and human exposure will require us to make sure that we're using proper personal protective equipment, including the gloves and safety glasses, absorb the spill with paper or cloth, dispose of any contaminated items in an appropriate chemotherapy disposal container, as we talked about, and refer to the SDS, the safety data sheet, for specific first aid measures if human exposure occurs. This all comes from a tip sheet that was available from ASORN at asorn.org. It's entitled Ophthalmic Mitomycin C, Top Tips for Safe Handling, Use, and Disposal. And I really recommend that you go to the website and become members of the American Society of Operating Room Nurses, who provide an awful lot of great information. And thank you to ASORN for this information that we received. And also thank you to Mobius Therapeutics, who has put us on to this whole thing. So again, we're going to try to have another episode coming up where we're going to talk a little bit more about various pharmaceutical issues, and this will be one of them.
John, I know you've worked with a lot of eye centers. This has got to be shocking to anybody that's been, you know, using these drops for a long time. So I just wanted to say, you know, we're going to follow this and keep you updated on any other changes. And I wanted to remind everybody, too, the mitomycin should not be handled by anybody who is breastfeeding, pregnant, or trying to conceive.
That's right. So this is, I know it's a drug that we don't speak about a lot. We don't think about a lot. Mm-hmm. We don't realize it is a hazardous drug and needs to be treated differently. So much more to come.
Yes.
So let's kind of get an update on some of the news from the industry. First of all, the registration is now open for the ASCA 2020 Winter Seminar. That's going to be January 16th to the 18th in New Orleans, Louisiana, and within our company. Battle lines are being drawn as to who's going to be going this year.
Oh, no, everybody wants to go.
So we always have to pick some sacrificial lamb who's going to have to stay back. But I think you're going to be seeing a pretty big contingent from Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies there. So this year's program, I'm very excited, was involved in putting it together. It features three specialized tracks that cover ASC management, coding and reimbursement, and back this year by popular demand. Man, Finance and Accounting, which is a program that I developed over 10 years ago with the ASC Association and been one of my favorite things. And I got some nice topics coming up in that area myself that I'll be teaching during the winter seminar. So if you want to hear me speak yet again and you haven't gotten tired of listening to me on this podcast, definitely come to the winter seminar. The nice thing also, Sue, is that the attendees can move freely between the tracks and join any of the sessions offered throughout the seminar. And I know you enjoyed that last year because you went back and forth between various things.
Yep.
So the best rates end September 30th. So check out the schedule and register today. For more information, visit ascassociation.org.
And as John mentioned, for our centers in New York State, the 2018 AHCF software was posted to the Health Commerce System, or HCS, to download for the completion of the 2018 HCF cost report. Please be advised that the 2018 HCF cost report filing deadline is October 15th, 2019. And if you've never filed this cost report before, or if you're just tired of the hassle, remember our team at AHS is always there to help. Feel free to reach out to John by calling him at 585-594-1167. It is a huge
undertaking. It is a big deal.
And
we are, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies is by far the largest preparer of cost reports in the state of New York. So we really know what we're doing. And Alex really enjoys doing it. I'm kidding. I'm not sure that he enjoys doing it, but he certainly is a master at it. And that's right. And we have a full, we actually bring on a additional staff this time of year to handle those cost reports. So we're gearing up right now. A lot of our part-timers are now almost working full-time to try to get this thing done so that we can meet the deadline for all of our clients by October 15th.
Yeah. And I saw something in Becker's ASC Review from the August 15th edition. They did an interview with Dr. Brian Busconi, who is an orthopedic surgeon and chief of the Division of Sports Medicine at UMass Memorial Medical Center in Worcester, Massachusetts. He had a great idea to make an email to the patient's videotaped post-op instructions, which I think especially is useful for the larger procedures like the total knee arthroscopy,
which has just been added to the list. Yes, this is you told me about this. This is incredible. What a great idea! It's like, why didn't we think about this earlier? So
I think he actually will include pictures. He makes it personalized to the patient, but you know, you don't have to do that. He said, then people will just make a general post-op instruction video and just email. And he's found even elderly people seem to be comfortable with the email. And he has found that he actually reduced the follow-up calls from patients by 60%. And it's not that we don't want them to call,
right?
But that just really shows how much more comfortable they are with things. And you know, even if you have somebody with you when you're having these procedures done, everybody's tired and stressed, and they don't always absorb everything you're saying. So if they have that, they can take a look at and just be reminded of some of those post-op.
Right. And they can just refer back to that video anytime they have it. It must make them feel much better. And let's face it, when you end up having to call, you know, the doctor afterwards, obviously it means that somewhere along the line, we either there's a complication or we failed to provide the patient with appropriate information to be able to, you know, get through the post-op.
Or we did, and they, the timing just wasn't right. They, and you know, by the time they call you, they've probably been stressing about it for a while. So how much better just to be able to them, you know, something to look at and remind themselves.
So we will put a link in the website once we get this episode dropped to the Becker's article.
And an OR manager from July 24th, there was a really interesting article about infection risks that they found that are due to lubricants on endoscopes. And I know, John, we've heard of different cases of contaminated scopes. And often you hear that the facility was following all the reprocessing procedures. So it's sort of like, where, you know, where did that come from? So Corey Ofsted, MSPH, a researcher and an expert on endoscope reprocessing failures, found that the off-label use of products for defoaming, lubrication, and products for bleeding control might be contributing to these failures. Though endoscope manufacturers have cautioned against the use of these products, endoscopists still sometimes use them, and you know they may consider them really essential to the process. There's simethicone that the endoscopists will find helpful to reduce the foaming and allow them to see better. So it actually is very helpful in that way, but simethicone or other products that maybe contain silicone often can't be removed from the endoscope.
And even after the reprocessing is done.
After the rinsing, the reprocessing. The problem is that they're not water soluble.
Okay.
It's an inert substance, so it doesn't interact with any products that are used to clean the endoscopes. Also hydrophobic, so you know it prefers not to mix with water. Therefore, any kind of rinsing, it doesn't always do what you need it to do. So another product was Silcospray. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's a silicone-based product that comes in an aerosolized can. It's supposed to be used as a lubricant for the hinges on the stainless steel instruments, but some staff of some centers were saying that they would spray it on the bronchoscope before putting it through the introducer sheath to make it slide more easily. And sometimes they would just spray it on the instruments to help them slide down the instrument channel, like if they were taking a biopsy. And, you know, it's not sterile. It also, again, does not wash out well. And following the instructions from the manufacturers, in 2010, Olympus sent out a letter to all their customers. And I'll just quote from this. Olympus recommends medical-grade water-soluble lubricants, such as KY jelly, lidocaine jelly, for the insertion tube of their flexible endoscopes. Experience in the U.S. market also suggests that PAM cooking spray is compatible with Olympus flexible endoscopes. However, Olympus makes no claim that PAM is suitable for use during endoscopy procedures. In addition, Olympus cautions customers against the use of petroleum-based, such as ointments, Vaseline, and silicone-based lubricants. Although these lubricants may not damage Olympus endoscopes, they may be very difficult to remove during reprocessing. So again, that seems to be the whole issue. For one thing, you want to be careful about what you're introducing into the patient field, but also as they were examining the endoscopes, they were finding there were like greasy or hard areas inside that they couldn't figure out until they really looked into it and found out often they were these products. So,
and they weren't completely cleaned at the end as a result.
Yeah, there are spots, particles and things in there. So they just said, make sure to consult with your infection preventionist because often they're not aware of it because it's just sort of a common practice and they haven't run it through them. And of course, the manufacturer's instructions. And they also recommended to inspect the inside of the endoscopes with a borescope, you know, to make sure that you're checking periodically to see that everything does seem to be out of there.
Okay.
So for more information, you can go to ormanager.com.
Very good. And thank you to OR Manager, a great magazine that I've written for in the past, and certainly a great resource for information such as this. I can't say that we've really made a conclusion on this one, but at least we're bringing it to everybody's attention.
And I think this article was sort of like a call to action. She was just saying we have to figure out really what can be used because these problems that the silicone and the simethicone solve really do need to be dealt with, but you also have to make sure you can clean them afterward.
So let's take a short break. We do have a new sponsor for the ASC podcast with John Gailey, and that's CareDirect, which is a company that manufactures medication security cabinets. So we're going to learn briefly about them. We'll come back for a continued discussion of the 2020 CMS proposed regulations.
On July 29th, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, released the annual proposed changes to the Hospital Outpatient Prospective Payment System and the Ambulatory Surgery Center Payment System for payment year of 2020. In our last episode, episode 62, we began our discussion with an overview of the new regulations, and in episode 60, John described how the annual CMS rate setting for hospital outpatient and ASCs works. So in this episode, we'll continue our discussion of pertinent aspects of the 2020 proposed rule.
So let's just do a quick summary of the proposed rule. CMS would continue to use the hospital market basket to update ASC payments for the calendar year 2020 through 2023 as the agency assesses the policy's impact on the migration of cases from the hospital outpatient setting to the ASCs. If the proposed rule were to be finalized as it was drafted, the ASCs would see on average over all of the covered procedures an effective update of about 2.7%, which is the same increase that the hospitals will get. Remember, though, that this doesn't mean that all of the Medicare rates will go up by 2.7%, only that the average increase is going up by 2.7%. Each CPT is reweighted every year based upon information provided to CMS from the cost reports filed by the hospitals. CMS is proposing to add 8 codes to the ASC payable list in 2020, and those new codes are going to be total knee arthroscopy, allograft implant, knee with scope, and percutaneous transluminal coronary angioplasty, percutaneous transluminal coronary angioplasty for an additional artery, percutaneous cardiac stent with angioplasty for on one vessel, percutaneous cardiac stent with angioplasty for additional vessels, percutaneous transcatheter placement of drug-eluting intracoronary stents with coronary angioplasty when performed on a single major coronary artery or branch, and percutaneous transcatheter placement of drug-eluting intracoronary stents with coronary angioplasty when performed with each additional branch of major coronary artery list.
Whew. I know.
I can't believe I got through all those, and hopefully I didn't mispronounce anything. But so the comments on the proposed rules are due September 27, 2019. The final rule will likely be released in early November, though it could be later, as they were almost 27 days late in getting the last regulations out. And then the new payment provisions will go to effect on January 1st, 2020. So the addition of new procedures continues Medicare's actions in two areas. First of all, the expansion of complex orthopedic cases and in particular joint replacements. So the newest ASC procedure and joint replacement procedure is total knee arthroplasty, or better known as TKA, which is total knee replacement. This is a highly effective surgical procedure which involves the replacement of the three components of a knee. So we're fortunate to start seeing some of these total joints being added to the list. We might be unfortunate that up until now we've been able to set much more favorable rates. Now with Medicare setting a rate, it's likely to bring the reimbursement down on previously negotiated rates. So I think this is a catch-22 here. Now it's being more acceptable in an ambulatory surgery setting, but unfortunately it could start setting the standard for the reimbursement in these procedures, which up until now we've probably been able to negotiate with a little bit more strength. And we should note that the national reimbursement for this procedure is $8,639.97, so it's pretty healthy. A second procedure that's been added is arthroscopy C surgical osteochondral autografts, also known as mosaicplasty, which includes harvesting of the autograft. And this is CPT 29867. So according to the International Cartilage Regeneration and Joint Preservation Society, better known as ICRS, mosaicplasty is a technique in which the cartilage, or the chondral lesions, and the bone and cartilage lesions are repaired by harvesting and transplanting cylindrical plugs of bone and cartilage. In the knee, these plugs are taken from less weight-bearing areas, termed donor sites, and inserted into drilled tunnels in the defective section of the cartilage. You can get a lot more information about this procedure at cartilage.org. So I was kind of getting excited about this because, you know, anything that's kind of new is always interesting. So this website provides a lot of great information. And the reimbursement for these procedures is $8,517.88. Again, that's national. So very exciting developments, I think, in the industry that as we start to see these being added. But as I said, I think it is a catch-22 that we might start to see the reimbursement in those centers that are currently doing them going down as this national rate tends to start sticking. Also, we have an expansion of cases that are generally not considered surgical and are, in fact, outside the normal surgical range of CPT codes. As we all know, or probably know, most of the cases that we perform in a surgery center are between the CPT code number 10,000 through CPT code number 69999. These newest procedures are in the 90,000 range, and they're specifically cardiac codes. So I think we're going to start seeing, cardiology becoming a much more viable ASC specialty here than it has been in the past. And I think we have to keep a very close eye on what's going on here. So the takeaways, I think, from this for the industry is there's continued acceptance of complex orthopedic procedures in the ASC setting. It also implies that total joint cases are likely to be increasing. More of them are going to be coming to the ASC Medicare, Medicaid paid list. And of course, the cardiology continues to expand the number of procedures that are included in the ASC payer list. So on the Medicare quality reporting side, CMS proposed the adoption of ASC 19, which is facility level 7-day hospital visits after general surgery procedures performed at ambulatory surgery centers for 2024 payment determinations and beyond. So no other measures have been proposed, though they are still seeking comments on the suspended ASC 1 through 4 measures. So this new measure for reporting a 7-day hospital visits, we talked a little bit about this, Sue, during the last episode. So this is reporting hospitalizations within 7 days after discharge from the ambulatory surgery center. This goes into effect in 2022. And it's a measure that we don't currently report, but that we will not have to report, but that hospitals will do it on our behalf. And as we talked about in the last episode, this emphasizes the importance of tracking this information in ASC. I think you mentioned at the last episode that generally we only do, hospitalizations within 48 to 72 hours. We need to be expanding that to 7 days. So this is perhaps a setup for the future, too. For now, Medicare quality reporting measures only affect our Medicare rates if we don't report. In other words, we're getting paid for reporting. Mm-hmm. The goal has always been that eventually our payment rates will be impacted by the results of our quality reporting. Mm-hmm. In other words, payment for results, much as what's been happening in the hospital setting. Hospitals already have measures that do have an impact on their payment rates. So that is, for example, if they don't keep their readmission rates low, they could face reductions in their Medicare rates. Similarly, as we move into the future of Medicare quality reporting, we could see ourselves subjected reductions in our rates if we have higher 7-day admission rates than our other centers.
But realistically, John, it's not likely that given our past history that we're going to see any high rates of admissions in any of our centers.
That's right. I mean, fortunately, we don't have other types of procedures. We do obviously don't hopefully lend themselves to rehospitalization. And I believe, too, that if they are hospitalized within 7 days, it might not be related to the procedure itself.
Probably, but something to keep an eye on and maybe think about how you can even get that information.
Right. And truthfully, too, again, we have to remember, we still have to track it, even if it didn't have anything to do with the surgical procedure.
Yeah.
But, if we don't report it, if we don't get that information, how are we going to be able to show in the future if somebody does question us that it was not related to the procedure? So definitely a thing that we keep an eye on. So also some things came out from in the new reimbursement regulation, proposed regulations, especially affecting the hospital outpatient department. So some of these provisions were interesting, even though they don't affect us. Mm-hmm. So one of them is increasing price transparency in hospitals. So for hospitals, this will be a requirement. It is not for surgery centers, but it is a little bit scary. So if, in the future we're required to do this, can you imagine the administrative burden? Yeah. So CMS is proposing to implement the president's executive order entitled Improving Price and Quality Transparency, which requires hospitals to publicly report all of their standard charges for items and services on an annual basis. So this requires the hospital to do this in a number of different ways, including they have to define what their standard charges are, what items and services are performed, requires them to provide a machine-readable file online that includes all the standard charges for all hospital items and services. It requires them to make public payer-specific negotiated charges for a limited set of shoppable services that are displayed and packaged in a consumer-friendly manner, and it makes it necessary to monitor hospital noncompliance by CMS with these requirements by issuing warnings, requesting corrective actions, and or imposing monetary penalties. So be prepared for this to hit our industry in the future. I think, fortunately,
kind of a trend.
Yeah, it is. And fortunately, we don't have to deal with it, but I think it's important that we keep an eye on what's going on so that we know what might be happening in the future. Along those same lines, the 2020 rules came out with some more news about site-neutral payments for hospital clinic visits. Again, this doesn't affect ambulatory surgery centers directly, but as we'll talk about at the end here, definitely could have an impact. So CMS is completing the implementation of a two-year phase-in of site-neutral payments, that is a Medicare physician fee schedule rate for the clinic visit, which is CPT G0463, which is a HCPCS code, hospital outpatient clinic visit for assessment and management of a patient. When this visit is provided at a hospital-owned off-campus site and reimbursed under the HOPD system, it will be reimbursed at the Medicare physician fee schedule rate, which is dramatically different than the reimbursement that would be received in an on-campus clinic site. So note that this CPT is the most common service billed under the HOPD OPPS system, and it is the same as the code used in the physician's office. CMS projects that the proposed change will result in a reduction in cost to the Medicare program of almost $810 million a year. Mm-hmm. And more importantly for patients, it's going to lower their copayments from about $23 to $9 in 2020. So this is a mixed blessing for ASCs. It's nice to see hospitals being put on an even playing field with non-hospital affiliated ambulatory centers. This is definitely an interesting trend that we have to keep an eye on. Already, this is the case for off-site HOPDs that are established after a certain date, and it continues the trend for site-neutral payments. So those outpatient departments that do ambulatory surgery center that were established off-campus after a certain date, they are receiving the ASC reimbursement rate. They're not getting the higher HOPD rate. So taken to an extreme, we could eventually see HOPDs being reimbursed the same as an ASC.
Yeah, and we would, of course, have preferred that instead we were reimbursed the same as the hospital.
That's right. So instead of selecting the lower the reimbursement rate, the higher the reimbursement rates, yes, we're going to get the lower the rate. But that of course, is never going to happen.
No.
And another negative here is that we'd lose our competitive advantage. We've always been able to say that our reimbursement rates are clearly cheaper than hospitals. So if this continues, that'll be one of the arguments that we're no longer going to be able to do. So I guess another mixed blessing here is that we could see hospitals just deciding not to do these procedures, as we've seen with some of the surgical procedures that we've seen moving or migrating to the ASC setting in the future. So if their reimbursement goes down, they might decide, it's just not the proper setting to be doing these things. I think most concerning was the proposed prior authorization for certain HOPD services. Again, this does not affect the ASC industry, but, who knows? It could happen. It could start moving to us. So CMS proposes to require prior authorization for the following five services to ensure that they're billed only when medically necessary. Mm. I guess based upon some studies that they've done, they found an unexpectedly high rate of use, and they'd like to reduce this trend. So these procedures, these five procedures are blepharoplasty, Botox injections, paniculectomies, rhinoplasty, and vein ablations.
Okay, so they're probably thinking a lot of these are cosmetic.
Correct. I think
medically necessary.
Right. Well, and of course,
they can be. They can be medically necessary. So
For example, blepharoplasty, if it impacts the site of an individual, that is effective. But usually, I think what happens with blephs is that, a patient's going to want to have a bleph done on all, both the upper and lower lids. Mm-hmm. Whereas from a medical necessity standpoint, at least according to the doctor who has observed that patient, it might only be covered for, the upper lids or one eye.
Yeah. And even Botox can be used for many medical issues. So I guess they just want to look into it a bit more.
Yeah. So this could be the future for us. So since blephs, rhinoplasty, and veins in particular are done in an ASC, let's stay tuned. Yeah. So I just wanted to finish by talking a little bit about some of the general trends in the different specialties with the rates. Eyes generally saw a bit of an increase. It's generally gone up a little bit either at or above the cost of living adjustment. So cataracts saw a jump of about 3.6%. After cataract, laser surgery has only gone up 1.23%. It's still amazing that those are still even on the list, actually, because so many of them are being done in the doctor's office. Gastroenterology is relatively the same for major procedures, so there was very little increase. For example, 43239, which is an EGD biopsy, is up 0.94%. 45380, colonoscopy and biopsy, is only up 0.76%, as is colonoscopy with lesion removal. Diagnostic colonoscopies is up by 0.5%. So most of those increases have been less than 1% increase. So if you're in gastroenterology, not much of an increase this year, but I guess that's better than a decrease as is happening in, you know, some sections. So none of the major areas really have any decreases this year. Orthopedics, the existing procedures are generally going up marginally, somewhat in keeping with the CPI. For example, knee arthroscopies, you know, like 29881, 29877, 29876, those are up 2.14%. Shoulder arthroscopy is also only up 2.14%, and rotator cuffs are up 1.7%. So about the cost of living adjustment, a little bit less than that, but at least it's going up. Pain management going up generally, but slightly less than the CPI. So manipulation of hip joints, the injection are up about 1.25%. The injections, epidurals are up about 1.92%. Again, I'm giving you the national numbers. And in the podiatry area, generally it's at or above the CPI. Hallux rigidus, with an implant is up 8.08%, and hallux valgus is up 2.14%. I'm going to post a spreadsheet on the website that includes a comparison of the proposed national rates to last year's numbers for your information. And if you're a member of the ASC Association, you can log on to the ASC Association. They have a wonderful spreadsheet there that you can use to specifically figure out your own rates based on the wage indexes for your area. Okay. So a great tool, reason enough to join the ASC Association. That's at ascassociation.org.
Let's take a short break and we'll come back and talk about upcoming events in the industry.
So, Sue, let's talk about some upcoming events in the industry. I had to wake you up a little bit after that second section there. I'm sorry. You know, when we start talking about numbers, your CPT eyes just gloss over.
Yes,
so,
yes.
As I am sure many nurses, but I think it's important, even if you are not on the finance side, you gotta know about this. So, sorry to put you through all of that. I note that I probably talk a little bit fast when I'm talking about, so you might have to slow down your podcast software so that you can listen a little bit slower to my speaking.
Or speed it up if you're not interested in the... No, I actually did some coding for a little, or learned about coding for a little while. So,
yeah.
Some of those codes from that end were interesting, but, obviously, though, it's important information to get. So,
right.
Okay. So,
every episode, we're going to inform you about upcoming events. And if you'd like your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com. I do have to say that I'm kind of disappointed people don't generally send me emails. I have to search for these things. So, please, if you are, you know, involved in an ASC association or have another event, please feel free to send me the information. I'd be glad to include it in our list here.
Definitely. And I also want to remind you that the ASC podcast with John Gailey is available to support your ASC association. And John is also available to speak, and we can record a podcast from your meeting,
which we will be doing in two upcoming places. Actually, three. We're going to be doing for the Ohio State Association, California, which I believe is
coming
just
right
a couple
up.
Weeks, and the New York State Association, which is in November. Those are the three that I can remember offhand. I know others are coming up also. The next ASC Association webinar is this week on August 20th at 1 p.m. It's called Lower the High Cost of Collecting from Your New Payer, the Patient.
The California Ambulatory Surgery Association's annual conference is September 4th through 6th in Monterey Bay, California. And that's where, as we said, we're going to be there.
That's right. Going to look forward to that. We're going to take a couple days in Newport Beach while we're out there to have, I guess we're going to a luau. Is that what's?
Yes.
Yes. So thank you for CASA for at least getting out to that coast so that we can have some fun in addition to doing, well, we're always having fun when we do their podcast.
Yeah, and that was a great conference last
it
time.
Is.
We got
it's
to talk
really,
to a lot of people, interview a lot of people. So looking forward to it.
Great job that they do out in CASA.
Yeah.
So Surgery Center Compliance Meeting will be September 23rd to the 24th in Newark, New Jersey.
The Michigan ASC Association, or MASA, annual meeting will be on Mackinac Island on September 26th and 27th.
The Tennessee ASC Association Fall Conference and Trade Show will be September 26th through 27th, the same days, at the Hilton Memphis in Memphis, Tennessee.
The South Carolina ASC Association's Infection Control Seminar is in Columbia, South Carolina on October 5th.
And then 3 days later, also the South Carolina ASC Association's fourth quarter membership meeting will be Columbia, will also be in Columbia, South Carolina, October 8th.
The Indiana Federation of ASC's Fall Conference and Trade Show is October 18th at 502 East Event Center in Carmel, Indiana.
The New York Metro ASC and Healthcare Management Symposium is November 1st, 2019 at the Marriott Marquis in New York City.
The New York State Association of ASC's Fall Conference is in Tarrytown, New York on November 6th and 7th.
The Washington ASC Association's 2019 Annual Education Conference and Trade Show is November 14th and 15th at the Tulalip Resort and Spa in Tulalip, Washington. Well, that's it for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again in a few weeks, and please spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, All Rights Reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.